Welcome to this all-new episode of The Wall Behind and Beyond in partnership with a More Just America Action Fund. I am your host, Philip A. Jones. We have a phenomenal show for our listeners today, as well as a remarkable show guest. Today, you will hear from the executive director of A More Just America, Chris Stevens. Find out who he is, what is the AMJA mission, and why this organization is so important for the criminal justice dialogue and advancing the conversation. Please welcome once again Chris Stevens to the show. What's good with you, bro? How you doing?
Oh, I'm good, Mr. Jones. I really appreciate you having me here today. Like I was saying a little bit offline, I'm just so impressed by your writing. And if anybody's listening to this for the first time, I hope that you go, find some of Mr. Jones' work because it's absolutely phenomenal. I mean, the way that he's able to, digress through these extremely complex issues and bring them to light in a compassionate, data-driven manner is just, it's just incredible. So I'm really glad to be here with you and to have this conversation.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate those words, man. Let's get to it. I got some questions for you, and I'm sure that listeners are really going to love what you have to say, because I like everything about what's going on over at AMJA. Can you tell our listeners where you're from and a little bit about your background?
Yeah, sure. I'd love to. So a little bit about my background and specifically how it relates to the American criminal justice system is essentially three parts. And so I'll start at the first part. The first part was when I was a juvenile, I became a ward of the court. And after that moment, I was cycled in and out of the system. I was, be put in a group home, run from the group home because of the conditions. I didn't want to be there. I'd live on the streets homeless for a couple of days until I, needed some food. And then I'd turn myself back into the juvenile hall system. And so I cycled like that from about age 11 to 15. And what really stuck with me was one moment within this incarceration where I refused to join a gang. And I was in a linen closet, just folding some clothes, going through my day. And two of the gang members came into the linen closet and they jumped me. They started beating me down pretty bad. I'm assuming the COs saw it on the camera because they rushed in pretty quickly. They sprayed everybody with mace, asked no questions, and then brought me to a solitary confinement cell. And so I remained there for 3.5 weeks. And at the time, I was 13 years old. I remember the severe, deprivation of any human contact, of natural and healthy food, of, comforting words from loved ones or family. I was just stripped away of all my humanity within that process. And I started to dissociate about 2 weeks in. I'll never forget like yelling out to the COs to let me get a phone call to my family. That's if they would have picked up. And they would come and bang on the door and say, we'll give you something to cry about if you keep whining to us. And so that was the sort of environment that I was in. And once I got out, I saw a psychiatrist. He diagnosed me with a dissociative disorder. Moving through life, that disorder brings me to my second point of contact with the American criminal justice system. And I knew that I wanted to do something new with my life. So I said, hey, why don't I join the military? And this is something that I might be able to do well in, even with this, slight dissociative disorder. I was able to get my file sealed when I turned 18 years old. It was an incredible experience for me. Luckily, my record got wiped off the face of this earth and I joined the military. And going into the military, it was about 4 or 5 weeks into basic training. We were in this huge formation, like 200 soldiers outside of this barracks building. And this officer comes walking out with these huge stacks of military jackets, as they called them, which was our file. It maintained all of our test scores. It maintained, fitness scores, everything about us, besides what kind of margarita we liked, And he comes out and he starts yelling out people's names. And I'm like, oh, I'm wondering what this is for. And my name gets called near the end. It's about 15, 16 soldiers get pulled in this room. And I'm thinking, Mr. Jones, I'm about to get kicked out of the military because they discovered my extensive criminal record as a youth. Maybe something went wrong and they didn't file the paperwork correctly. Whatever this may or may not have been was running through my mind. And I entered this room and I sat down and they said, hey, because of your, test scores and your physical abilities, we're recruiting you into the Honor Guard in Washington, D.C. And it was a big, huge sigh of relief. I didn't know what the Honor Guard was, but they showed all these videos of soldiers rappelling out of helicopters and riding around with the Secret Service and the president. And I said, okay, sign me up. It's an honor to go to this unit. So I went, had a stellar career, 5 years in the military, just under 5 years, did presidential escorts for Barack Obama, Secretary of Defense. And so I had this moment of reflection when I was sitting at former President Barack Obama's inaugural ball in Washington, D.C., and I'm sitting there drinking Blue Label with some congressmen, because I didn't know the congressman personally, but they just liked me because I had my military uniform on, and they were sort of gassing me up. And I sitting there and I was going, wow, I came from a homeless family to a ward of the court through the American criminal justice system, 36 misdemeanors, 3 felonies. I had an extensive record as a juvenile, but because I was able to get my record clear, I was able to move on and have a successful life. But there's so many people that do not have this opportunity. And I guess we can touch back to that right after I get into the third part of my contact with the American criminal justice system. I got out. Oh, go ahead. Okay, Mr. Jones. And I got out of the military. I was medically retired, from a non-combat related injury. And I thought my life was over. But what that taught me, looking back on it now, is that there's no such thing as an ending, just an infinite set of beginnings, no matter how hard things seem in life. Because I was in a bed, unable to walk properly for about 3 or 4 months, 6 months almost, doing pool PT every day, having to retrain my body and my central nervous system how to do these basic tasks. But, I may not run anymore, but, I can walk and I'm good now. But I got out and I said, well, if I can't use my body, as my weapon, then I have to start utilizing my mind. And so I went to college. I, studied political science and law during my undergraduate. And it was at that time I got really connected with the idea of helping facilitate change within the American criminal justice system because of the negative experiences that I had with it, solitary confinement, being rotated in and out, these sorts of things. And so I started working for a nonprofit, and then I worked for another nonprofit. Both were centered in, the justice system. Incredible experience. I was with some really brilliant minds that taught me a lot for years and years. And then I went on to work for a senator as an advisor in Arizona. And so another point in my life going, I have switched and started using my mind to facilitate change for the last 5 or 6 years. And here I am, somebody else, a member of Congress, wants my counsel on certain issues because she believed in me. And so that was an incredible experience. But right at this time, my stress levels were really up because I had a lot going on and I was dissociating a lot. And so I went into a psychosis, completely disconnected from reality. And this is my third and final point with the American criminal justice system, is that I went to a VA hospital trying to get care, and they denied me. They said, you're not a threat to yourself or anyone else. You're just a little manic, as they were calling it. You know, you can see a psychiatrist in a couple of weeks. But every day I went back to the same VA in New York trying to get care, and they denied me 7 days in a row. And so on the seventh day, I was so angry and so disconnected from reality that I broke the law that day, and I shouldn't have done it. I stood up and I yelled at a doctor and I threatened him. I said, I need care and I need it now. And I was so distressed and emotional at the time, I wasn't thinking clearly. And so I made a threat to the doctor and I got arrested for a federal assault, a misdemeanor federal assault. And even though I didn't make contact with this individual, I disturbed, as they call it within the code, disturbed an employee during federal business hours on federal property. That's simple assault. It's like the lowest federal crime you could get. I was in jail for 3 months. I entered jail in a psychosis. They put me, it was at a federal holding facility in upstate New York, and they put me in solitary confinement because I was having a psychosis from childhood trauma of being put in solitary confinement. So everything was sort of compounding on top of one another. And I got out after 3 months, and I had to stay in there for 3 months because the federal system says in that jurisdiction that they only have court every 4 months for federal cases. So I was just holding, waiting for that. A lot different than county. And, you know, I'll never forget what my public defender said. She said to me, well, you're just caught up in the system now. I said, how is this fair that I'm a veteran going to get care at a VA hospital? They wouldn't give it to me. And now I'm locked up because I was in a psychosis. And she said, that's just the system that you're in. And so that's the end of my story with the American criminal justice system. But it's because of what that public defender said to me, and I'm sure we'll lead into this question, is why I started A More Just America, is because I don't believe that people should ever be looked at and be said and told, you're just in a bad system. And so we're trying to create change within that system.
Absolutely. That's powerful, man. Powerful testimony, man. Very compelling. It's a lot to unpack, but I'm ready for it. And I just want to say, I was listening to you. You know, you talked about triggers. You talked about traumas. You talked about gang prevention, the correctional staff as warders versus mentors, and you being hurt rather than healed. You know, you said a lot of things, man, and I was like, this is what it's all about, man, and it's all coming to fruition. Because you say devastation to triumph. You were able to do it, but all people are not able to do so. And then that quote you had, infinite set of beginnings, man, stuck with me. So I just want to get you the questions because you answered a lot, but there's still so much more for the listeners to take away from this conversation. So thank you so much, man, for breaking it down, your history, your background. And now I wanted to ask you, you are a justice impacted individual yourself. How did that shape your advocacy around criminal justice reform? Now, you kind of answered it, but specifically speaking, there's probably a lot that you can say in regards to what is it that you feel can be done specifically to shape your advocacy around criminal justice reform? Or do you think that that was something that you have already said in terms of your first answer? Because if so, I will go to another question, but I wanted to give you a chance to still answer that.
No, I'd love to be able to answer that, Mr. Jones. And thanks for the kind words and you know, picking up what I'm putting down. And so I appreciate that. I believe in a quote by this gentleman named Glenn Martin. He says that those who are closest to the problem are closest to the solutions, but often farthest away from the resources to carry out their solutions. And so me being close to the issue, like you are, being inside of the American criminal justice system, how you are, I feel viscerally connected to the individuals that I've met within that justice system. And I believe in everybody's innate potential for change after they have realized that, hey, what I did was wrong, and I'm willing to change past that. And so I went through that process, and I'll never forget one time when I was in juvenile hall, I was in a room with this big, huge gangster. I mean, like, he was from the north side of town of Santa Cruz, and he had tattoos all over his neck, and I was just polar opposite of him. But I remember sitting in there thinking that he was like this demon and this devil that was going to hurt me. And one day he saw me reading a book. It was a James Patterson book, How to Catch a Spider. And he looks at me and he goes, what's that book about? And I say, oh, it's just, you know, a fiction about a detective. And he goes, I've never read a book before. And I was like, really? Well, have you ever wanted to? And he's like, yeah, I can't really read. And so I looked at him and I said, well, if you want, I can start this book over and read it out loud. And at first he was like, no, you know, F you, that's crazy. I would never do that. And then a couple of days go by and he sat down and he said, listen, I'm going to beat your ass if you ever tell anybody about this. So I'll still leave his name out of it in case he finds me. But, you know, he said, I'd like you to read me some of that book, and I'll never forget that. And I don't think he used the word please. It was something like, you know, yeah, let's do it or whatever. But I started reading to him, and I read him this entire book over this 4-day period. And I can remember him falling asleep when I would do it. And at the time, I didn't know the significance of that. But looking back on it now, is after reading this great book, by Dr. Eric Burney about human nature and the soul. And it basically says that every individual has an inner child somewhere. And every single person that's sitting in a cell, no matter their age, no matter what they've done, they have that child that wants to be nurtured. And I think that's where a lot of crime comes from, is because people have so much generational trauma. They have so much trauma in their current generation, socioeconomic reasons, but it all comes together that I think that everybody at the end of the day just wants to feel safe and loved at some point. And so I was able to relay those feelings over to this individual, even though he never voiced it. And so I always remember him. And I think about the millions of people that are incarcerated today. And I want to help them because I think it's the right thing to do. Because at the end of the day, all of us are equals and we're the same.
Yes, yes. Absolutely, man. Shout out to Glenn Martin. You know, you mentioned him. He was on our show last year. Great guest, doing big things. I like that. You spoke about generational trauma. You spoke about a child being nurtured, all of us having an inner child. But even the most hardcore gang members of just human beings. They might have been through some things and experienced some things, but they're still humans. They're not monsters. They're not any of that. They have children. They have parents. They have family members. And they go through everything that everybody else goes through. They process it differently. So thank you so much for sharing that with us, man, because that's needed, man, and people need to hear that. From what I read on the website, the entire leadership team is made up of justice-impacted individuals. Was this by design, or did it just happen somehow?
It was 100% by design. I interviewed 16, 17 folks, and I am so grateful for the team that we have. We have, you know, a woman, Dr. Clover Perez, who has a doctorate. She's brilliant. Thinker. We've got a former judge and lawyer, you know, Jessica O'Brien. I could keep going about this list, but it is absolutely incredible to see a formerly incarcerated team come together in this fashion. And I hope that it shows the world that every interaction that we have with them is a positive one because the data shows that in social, breaking down social barriers and stigmas about folks that are previously incarcerated, the best way to break down that stigma is to have positive contact. And so I wanted to build an organization that every leadership role is filled with previously incarcerated individuals, because not only are we trying to carry out our mission, but we're truly living and embodying it by being a previously incarcerated team. So it was all by design. And what's so cool about our organization is I sat back and I thought about all the large nonprofits in the reform ecosystem, as they call it. And there's a lot of EDs, executive directors, who stay there for a long time, and maybe rightfully so. Maybe they're truly brilliant at what they do. But in my organization, I didn't want there to be a glass ceiling in any part of our organization. And so not only is everybody previously incarcerated, but every 2 years, I am rotating out the executive director, my position right now, and I'm giving away my job to a member of our either board or our team of advisors. And so the next person up is Marcia King to be the executive director. And then I'm going to move into the board of directors. And so you can come in literally as a previously incarcerated individual into our organization, get paid $50 an hour to be an advisor, because we pay everybody $50 an hour. We believe that there should be a good wage, you know, if you're working hard. And you can move from an advisor to a director to an executive director and all the way up to the board of directors. And so I did that because I wanted to give people a chance to truly show who they are, and being a previously incarcerated team, I think, was the best way to do that.
Hey, man, that's dope. Ain't no other organizations out there doing that, man. And that's a unique thing. I think it's so compelling, and it gives those who have been justice impacted the opportunity to basically contribute to the change that they've become. That's amazing, man. And shout out to Marcia King and all the others on the advisory board and the team, because you're showing that the next man up is a real philosophy in this organization. So when you decide that, you know, I'm going to go and do something else to help support the organization, we got somebody else that can step up and take the reins and going to be just as amazing and just as powerful in that position. So that's powerful, man. And again, that's unique.
Yeah, and for we're excited about it.
You know, oh, yeah, for sure. I was going to say, in full disclosure, as an incarcerated individual currently, you hired me as a paid advisor. And to be a part of the More Just America family, you know, I was wondering what was the idea behind it, but you just broke it down and explained it for the listeners. I appreciate you, man, for bringing me on as well. That's amazing, too, man, because I'm still inside for all those who don't know.
Well, I didn't have an overall strategy with bringing you on. It's just the moment I read your work, I said, man, this is a light in the darkest place of America right now. And when I mean dark, I mean, you know, bad conditions, you know, harassment from the guards, you know, no nutritional value to the meals besides barely keeping you alive, you know, charging you money just to make a phone call, using people and folks in there as slave labor, saying as it can be in the 14th Amendment. And things of this nature are so profoundly disgusting to me that we treat human beings this way. And so me coming to this thought was in part by reading your work and realizing that we need to listen to people at all different levels of this justice system. So we have somebody like you who's in the worst part of it right now. And God bless you. I hope you're released soon. And, you know, I can't imagine every day in there. You know, I've never been in a long-term prison sentence, so I can't relate. But what I can say is that what you're doing is incredible. And that's why we wanted to bring you on the team, is because we believe in you. Yeah.
That's dope. Thank you so much, man. You talked about a light in the darkness. It's the darkest place in America if you think about a stress-filled environment. You know, the reason I wanted to work, it was not just to take care of my family with whatever I could provide, but it was to have a head start with my eventual transition. You know, I wanted to start showing how one successfully reenters. Thus, we wrote the workbook, Exit to Excellence, because we wanted to be able to show them this is my process. This is exactly what I had to address. I started with trauma, and then we came all the way down and addressed all the other needs of those who are inside of the system waiting to be released. So I thank you for that, man, and giving me the opportunity. Hey, everybody. If you are enjoying the show, don't stop here. Check out my YouTube channel at The Wall Behind and Beyond to become a subscriber. Also, if you'd like to learn more about the projects and work we are doing going forward, you can do so by checking us out at www.pajconsultingllc.com. Thank you again and enjoy the show. Tell us what makes AMJA different than most other criminal justice reform organizations out there currently.
Okay, well, I'll give you the candid answer to this. And it's going to require a little framing. So within the criminal justice reform ecosystem, and when I say that, it just describes all of the major nonprofits that are involved in reform. There's a dichotomy between the conservatives and the progressives. The progressives dominate this space. They have the most funding. They have the largest institutions backing them. And they are, in essence, still playing the political game with the left. I mean, with the right side. They're still making this a political issue that either you're an ideological purist from the left that believes that you should tear the whole system down, or you're a conservative on the right who believes that we need more jails and police. And so I looked at that ecosystem for years while I was working as an advisor and for two other nonprofits within that ecosystem. And I said, you know, it took both Democrats and Republicans to build this massive complex of prisons, jails, and police stations. It's going to take both Republicans and Democrats to make it more just and more effective within the mission of keeping both the community safe that is affected by the criminal justice system and those who are within the American criminal justice system. And so our whole thought was, why don't we truly be not a left of center organization or a right of center organization, but a true center organization? And my voting record in Arizona, which is the first state that we're going to be working in 2024, is I voted for both McCain and Congresswoman Sinema. So I voted for both a Democrat and a Republican. It's in my blood to be bipartisan. I don't care who's in office. I don't care if they're on the right or they're on the left. What I care about is that they make effective change in my community. And I think one of the best things that a community can do for itself is to focus on criminal justice initiatives, such as rehabilitation over incarceration. And what I mean by that is there's data-driven formulas out there by other countries, such as Norway, that has dropped their recidivism rate to 22% when the U.S. is still standing strong at 77%. And so they're using rehabilitative services to, in essence, help an individual instead of just punish them, beat them down, and let them die in a cell. And so that's an initiative that I believe in and our organization believes in. And so to carry out this goal of making a system that actually helps people instead of destroy, kill, maim, murder, stab, rape, beat down, and not give enough food to, is to be bipartisan in nature. And so I think that's what makes us truly different than other organizations, is that we both endorse Republicans and Democrats, And we have our eye on one goal, which is separating the issue of criminal justice initiatives from the political space and showing people that this is about keeping communities safe and the people inside of the justice system safe. And so overall, our idea is a safer America. And that's what our organization is pushing towards.
Man, hey, I agree with you 100%, man. That's why I consider myself to be more of an independent, because I've seen some people on both the right and the left who've had great ideas in terms of how do we reform the criminal justice system? How do we make it work? If it's supposed to be about corrections, there has to be an end in the beginning for someone to come from one point to another, not just to be stagnated within the system or to be labeled where though they can't recover. And so to me, politics around this issue has to be set aside. If you think about it, even when the guy Trump was in office, he did try to do some type of initiative in terms of Second Look Acts and all that. Why have we stopped this discussion? Just because we wasn't behind it, or the person that was behind it was someone that we don't agree with politically? So we can't stop the discussion. It has to be an open discussion, and it has to be put back on the table. If Norway can achieve it, then most certainly the most wealthiest, powerful nation in the world can achieve this if we take the politics out of it.
Absolutely, and I agree with what you're saying 100%. You referenced Norway. You reference the, conditions. And at the end of the day, these are human beings, we're talking about. This shouldn't be a political issue. It should be a human being issue. It should be like, why are we putting 13-year-old children in solitary confinement cells, having that, ends up being lifetime disorder that negatively affects your life, And that's just one story. There's so many people. I remember I read about 4 months ago, a man in an Atlanta jail had passed out inside of his cell and died. And by the time they found him 3 days later, he was being eaten by bugs, like thousands of bugs. And they showed photos of this cell. And I'm saying this is happening in the most powerful, like you're saying, most powerful, most, wealthiest hegemonic force on earth. Why is this happening? And truly to dissect this, I think what it comes down to is where we need to start, which our organization is starting in, is with the language that we use. And so earlier I said criminal justice initiatives. Our organization doesn't use the word criminal justice reform anymore. And because the reason is if I walk into a Republican's office and say, hi, I'm here to talk about criminal justice reform, they're going to look at me and say, I love the idea, but my constituents won't. So this is a worthless conversation. If I walk into a Democrat's office and I say, hey, I'm here to talk about public safety, they're going to say, oh, that's too conservative for me and my voters. Sorry about that. So we're to truly make change. We sat back and we thought, well, we don't even have the language created yet to describe what we're trying to do, because no other organization has truly been bipartisan and nonpartisan in this space. And so we're using the word criminal justice initiative. And what does that mean? Criminal justice initiative is simple. It means that we want communities to be safe, and we want the people involved in the criminal justice system to be safe. And we could stem 200 different strains from that. But at the nucleus, when you hear criminal justice initiative, it's safety for everyone. And that's what we're after.
Just another comment on what you just said, criminal justice initiative. That's dope. Words do mean everything, and words are non-starters on the one side or the other if you're associated with politics. And so it's good when you have a word that doesn't offend either side. And I like that approach that you're taking, because we cannot reach one side without reaching the other. So we have to think about that. So what are you currently working on, and how do we bring about more public education around this subject?
Oh, okay. I'm excited to talk about this. So our organization is, we have a C3 and a C4 that are both active. And, you know, that's a nonprofit 501c3 and a nonprofit 501c4. I didn't even know what a C4 was until about a year and a half ago. And so the difference between the two organizations is that the C4 can, in essence, be politically active, and a C3 can't in this manner. And so we're going to be focusing on three areas. The first is narrative, which we're starting to create a new narrative with the new language. The second is media, where we're going to be spreading messages throughout media, throughout social media, mainstream media, commercials, these sorts of things. So within the media, it's basic political strategy. We're going to carry in our third part of our three-part strategy, which is endorsements. So we're going to be endorsing folks after extensive interviews with them. We have lobbyists on the ground working with us. We're going to have coalition meetings. We're really going to see who aligns with us. And we're looking to get into key races. In Arizona is the state that we're going to be all hands on deck in for 2024. And the reason we choose Arizona is because it's a purple state, number one. So it's got almost an equal number of Democrats and Republicans in it. That's strike one. Strike two is that Governor Katie Hobbs just got recently elected, and she created Arizona's first criminal justice panel that is made up of a great team that they have, and they advise the governor, and they also do prison oversight. And so she has a desire to see change. Arizona's a really tough state to work in, but we're up for the challenge. We're up for the fight. We're essentially going in and backing key races and then opposing folks that we don't believe that would make the criminal justice system safer for everyone. And so that's what we're going to be doing in Arizona, where we're going to be at, what we're doing. And we have a website that anybody can go to, amorejustamericaaction.org. We even have a join us tab on there. If anybody wants to get involved, it's just got a box, email address, name. That's all the information we need. You in the box, you're going to put what you can contribute. It doesn't matter if you're a intern. It doesn't matter if you're a doctor. It doesn't matter if you're a big business. We want to hear from you. I believe that working with a diverse team is incredibly important. And at my own sort of existential belief of reality itself lies the idea that ideas themselves help form the reality that we live in. And so it's my job as the executive director to get our team the resources to make those ideas a reality. And so we have an incredible team. And I remember I did one podcast 6-7 months ago, and then an intern reached out, and now she's working with us. So we've had people reach out that are in media that want to get involved. We want to hear from you. And again, you reaching out to us one day could lead to you being the executive director. And so it's an exciting journey through our organization, and we want to hear from anyone in any capacity. And just please, in layman's terms, tell me how you think you can help, and I'll reach back out within a couple of days, I promise.
Yeah, that's right. I was listening to you, and I was thinking, most modernized countries, they have sentencing caps. We're like one of the only modernized countries in the world still giving people life without and death penalty. That's all a thing of the past. That's draconian. And I think that this could be achieved on a state level. When you talk about legislative work and lobbying and all that, that's something. That's one of my ideas and one of the things that I promote in my organization and in my business model. So I hope that that's something also that we can explore going forward as we address the strategies. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Of course. Yeah. I think that. Well, maybe you could speak on this better. How much different of a person were you when you committed your crime than who you are today, years later?
Man, excellent question. Thank you for asking, man. You sound like the interviewer. I was 19 years old, man. I was misdirected. I was a traumatized youth. Running the streets, you know, coming from a background, parents addicted to drugs, alcohol, basically raising myself. So, you know, I take full responsibility for my crime. End up shooting a young guy. Fortunately, he's still alive. You know what I mean? That's the thing that haunts me. But at the same time, I'm just grateful that he did not die. But what I was thinking is that I was a whole different person. You know, it took me years in prison to mature because as a teenager at 19, even though I was considered an adult in the state of Maryland, I was actually younger than my age, you know, my mindset, far back goes, right? So I think that when you do a lot of time, it doesn't take 30 and 40 years for a person to discover their faults and learn how to grow from their past and their pains and their traumas. They just need help. And I was able to change some things about myself due to the fact that I was able to understand more what had happened and how to re-strategize my growth and my development. So I don't want to go off on my story, but I just wanted to answer that for you is that we all change when we come in as kids. When you become an adult, you start to see and developing and grabbing newer values for yourself. And so you start to see that the things that you did before, even if you were in a place where you had you didn't have a lot of choices, that they were still wrong and that they were still destructive. You know what I'm saying? So that's all I can say on that.
Absolutely. And I think you put it beautifully. That's why I wanted to ask you. And I think at the core, that is why we should not have draconian laws like life without parole, things of this nature. You know, people change. You know, I think that it's absolutely egregious that in the United States, we can say one nation under God, and under that God, all of us can be forgiven, but we can't forgive each other. And so if the thing that created us, you know, Buddha, Allah, Jesus, whatever someone believes in, or maybe something in between or completely outside of that box, you know, whatever created us, if that can forgive us, then I believe that we should be able to forgive each other. And if someone does their time, I think they should get out, get their record expunged and sealed. You know, I would have never been able to join the U.S. Army unless I had my file sealed. And so I want the listeners to think about maybe if they don't have a criminal record and a conviction, let's just put up one of my former bosses up for an example. President Barack Obama was my commander in chief. And he openly said in interviews that he used cocaine in college. The difference between him and someone who's not president may be because he didn't get caught that day. Maybe if he was caught and arrested and convicted of carrying, you know, a Schedule I drug on him, that he may have never been president. And so I want people to think about, has there ever been a time where you, you know, drove home with a little bit too much in your blood, too much alcohol? Has there ever been a time where you tried a drug? Has there ever been a time where you, you know, I don't know, checked off a box in your taxes that you shouldn't have? Something. You know, the difference between you, the listener who has never been caught for what they've done, and someone in jail is just that the circumstances were completely different. And so, you know, I just hope that resonates because it always does with me. Yeah. You know?
For sure, man. Thank you. That's powerful. I'm a proponent of restorative justice, first of all. I do believe that we have to first take accountability, address the issues that led to our crimes. You know, not to say there's not innocent people out there. I'm just talking about for those who take responsibility. But once you do that, the only way to restore justice is to come together with the victim to heal on a two-pronged basis. So If I do the work and I heal, I come to the table and I say, you know, I'm taking responsibility for my actions, and I would like to make amends with the person I harmed. That's the recipe for a healthy society. Until we get that in our thought process or our mentality as a nation, instead of always thinking about, you know, you committed a crime, you deserve what you got, we don't have anything for you. These are still our neighbors. These are still the people that are coming home to our communities. Do we want them to be broken, or do we want them to be healed so that they don't further commit crimes or do things that's going to harm society? So, again, we just got to rethink the way that we see the bigger picture when it comes to the issue. But you spoke about all the things that AMJA is doing and how they plan on approaching it. You even spoke about how do you appeal to legislators on both sides of the fence, having worked on both sides and talked to people from different sides, and knowing that it takes a village, so to speak, because we got to have everyone buy into the concept. Do you think that the lobbying aspect of it and the legislative aspect of it is the key to breaking open the conversation so that we can get a buy-in from both sides?
That's an excellent question. I believe that it's going to be a two-step process. The first objective within this two-step process is to remove criminal justice initiatives from the political space and make them their own issue. But to get to that, you have to play the game that's currently set up within Washington and in every state. And that game is, in essence, political warfare. And you going to a fight without all the tools at your disposal, you're most likely going to lose. And so, to be transparent with our organization, one of our favorite aspects of what we do is opposition research. And so that describes public records, could be interviews with friends and family, whatever it may be, whatever we have to do to learn about the people that we support to truly understand them and those who we oppose is what we're willing to do. And so I think that deploying all the political strategies that are out there, utilizing lobbyists, the research aspect, data and polling, all these are key components to showing up as a real player within the political space. Because if we don't do that, then we're just going to get the meetings and people are going to say, okay, I'll support you. But, you know, human beings, for the most part, you know, they're incentively driven off base what is going to favor them and their interests within the political space. And so we have to give them a reason to support our cause, and that's exactly what we're going to do.
That's what's up. I like that. I think that's the perfect remedy and the perfect recipe going forward with that. What would you like our listeners to take away from this interview?
Sure. So it's a little existential in nature. Forgive me. You know, I really like philosophy and this sort of thing. So, but in essence, to walk up to it is, you know, regardless if there is a divine creator or not, or if it is just the Big Bang, all of us human beings that we know right now are the most intelligent, compassionate, beautiful beings that this universe has ever created. And it's here on this little earth. And then this earth is divided into countries, and it's divided into states, and it's divided into cities and towns. And within that, there are people who are struggling to eat. There are people who are struggling to survive, to feed their family. And I want the listener to think about, if I stripped you of all your financial resources, if I stripped you of being able to attain a job because you have a record, if I stripped you of a fully developed, well-nurtured brain because of the generational trauma that's been applied on it, and then I threw you out into the world, how would you want to be treated? And that's the question that I want to leave to the listener, is what if we were a little bit more compassionate to the folks inside and realized that they are just as powerful and just as beautiful as us. And most likely their circumstances put them where they are today. And so the question is, what would happen if we just were a little bit more compassionate to those folks? And I think that that should give people something to think about.
Most definitely. Man, I want to thank you so much, man, for coming on. I feel like, you know, it's eye-opening in a lot of ways. And I feel like the listeners will take something from it. And I believe that a lot of people will want to get involved. You've told them how they can get involved, where they can get involved. Is there any last words or any other things that they should know in order to learn more about AMJA going forward?
No, just pop on our site. If you find me on LinkedIn, my email address is chris@amorejustamerica.org. I literally sit around all day hoping that people email me wanting to get involved. I think that, you know, like we discussed before, ideas are the nucleus of changing reality. And any idea someone has, I want to, you know, really analyze and look at, and it could lead to something great for you. And so if that's what you want. And so, yeah, I just really want people to know that I am very excited to hear from them if anyone reaches out.
For sure, for sure. I'm pretty sure once we go take this show on air, out there on the air, that a lot of people are going to reach out to you, talented people, man, and that's what you're looking for. So, again, man, take care, man. It was a great interview. You know, I love talking to you. I learned a lot more about your story, your background, and why you was motivated to do what you do, man. Keep up the good work. And I'm right there by your side helping out in the cause, man. Anything I can do, you already know, I'm just a call away. So stay up, man. Take care and have a great day, man.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Jones. I really appreciate your time and bringing me on. It's been an honor.
Absolutely.